This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
I'm Helen Farmer. Great to have you with us today. On today's episode, are you suffering in silence? A bit of a health special. Adult incontinence has a huge social stigma around it, despite millions suffering. We were speaking to one health professional about what some of the symptoms are, some of the causes, and indeed what treatment can look like to quite literally change your life. I was also chatting to Douglas, who recently recovered from shingles, and finding out from Dr. Ahmed, a consultant in infectious diseases, about why we get it and why we might get it again and again. Healthy Hania was sharing some realistic fitness tips during Ramadan and turning our attention to children. How can theatre help with confidence? We asked some of the performers from the Courtyard Playhouse. And who better to ask when it comes to the future of finance than a young investor himself, a 17-year-old joining us live to talk about a competition he's launched to help your teen become the next big thing. And a new pet app has been launched to hopefully keep track of your furry friend. Talking health on the show today and some startling facts around our topic this afternoon. It's a subject that millions of people are struggling with and embarrassed to talk about. Struggling in silence, and that's incontinence. Urinary incontinence affects around 200 million people worldwide, and reports out of Australia. Apparently there are more adult incontinence products than baby nappies that end up in landfill, and by 2030 it could be 10 times higher. So what can we do about this? And I think even having conversations about this on the radio is actually really, really important. And as I said, you can, of course, reach out and get in touch with us if you've got any questions, because joining us live on the line now from Corniche Hospital Aesthetic Clinic is lead physician Dr. Tracy Sims is with us. Dr. Tracy, how are you?
Hello. Hi, Helen. I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for joining us today. And I would imagine you must have an awful lot of very upset people in your clinic, because I would imagine a lot of people do suffer in silence and shame before they get to the point of being able to reach out and get some help. And I'm really grateful for your time today, and already messages coming in on this topic, which just goes to show how many people are indeed struggling. I'd love it if you wouldn't mind giving a bit of a definition, not too doctorly, if you don't mind, on what incontinence is, just so we can get a greater understanding, please.
Great. Thank you, Helen, for the opportunity to talk with you this afternoon. We know that up to 45% of women at some point in their life suffer from urinary incontinence. What we mean by incontinence is really a difficulty or inability to control when the urine or the stool comes out, or you void. So we all like to have control of when we void so that we can go about our daily lives and then use bathroom facilities, go to the toilet when it's convenient. Incontinence is when one doesn't have that control. And we know that this can be a really embarrassing situation for women and men. And there's still a lot of stigma surrounding this. And actually, the research shows that women may suffer in silence without actually consulting any medical profession about their problem for up to 3 years or more before they will come and admit that they would like some help.
Did you say 45% of women are struggling to some extent?
Yeah, up to 45% of women at some point in their lives will have a difficulty with urinary incontinence.
I think it's really important to stress that that number is incredibly high, which means it's common, but this isn't normal. You know, you don't need to be living this way. And we are, as I said, we're going to be talking about some treatment and management. But before we get to that, I want to know a bit about the whys. You know, and you mentioned there women in particular suffering and struggling. Why is that?
Okay, well, the first thing to say is that there are several different forms of urinary incontinence. There's the form which we call stress incontinence, which is when you cough or sneeze or run or jump, that a bit of urine can leak out. There's another form called urge incontinence, which is where you think, oh, I've got to go to the bathroom now. And sometimes if you put your hand on the door handle of the bathroom, you think, oh, that's it, the urine's coming. And then there's mixed incontinence, because some women suffer from both, a mixture of urge and stress incontinence. Now, traditionally, one of the most common things with women is that when women have babies, so when they're pregnant and also when they deliver vaginally, the muscles that fill in the bottom of the pelvis, it's called the pelvic floor, and it's made up of muscles and ligaments and connective tissue, and that forms like a sling or a hammock around the urethra, which is the tube from the bladder to the outside. It's about 4 centimeters long in women, and normally the muscles of the pelvic floor sling around this tube and hold it at an angle, and that forms a kind of sphincter to help to hold the urine in. So women who are pregnant or have had pregnancies or who have delivered vaginally, babies' heads are quite big when they come through and can cause some damage to the muscle of the pelvic floor or just some stretching. They find it more difficult, with the pelvic floor being weaker, to control that outlet of the bladder, mm-hmm. to produce enough pull on the urethra to control when the urine comes out. And they may find that when they cough, sneeze, run, jump, stand up quickly, sit down quickly, then a few drops of urine may leak out.
As you said, women waiting years before going to seek help and you know, experiencing these symptoms before getting a diagnosis. Once you do get someone in clinic, Dr. Trace, tell us a little bit about what might happen during examination and basically what you're hoping to achieve during that session, because I think it's really important to destigmatize that a little bit and demystify what might happen so women are feeling a bit more confident about reaching out.
Yeah, absolutely. The way that I run a pelvic floor clinic here at Cornish Hospital, and there's several ways in which we kind of make it really friendly. It's a largely women-only space, and it's really quite lovely. It's done out quite lovely, and we also use a questionnaire when women come to the clinic, because we know that often it's easier as a first step to answer questions on a piece of paper about what your symptoms are before you're asked to verbalise them. So we use quite an extensive questionnaire, which we have available in English and Arabic, that women can fill in at their leisure while sitting in our comfy waiting area. And then when I see women for the first time, I would ask them perhaps to just talk me through a little bit about what it is that brings them to the clinic, what they're hoping to work through while they're with us. And then we go through the questionnaire together. Mm-hmm. And then we do an examination. The examination is along the lines of a normal gynecological examination, but we do some things to make it a little bit more comfortable. We have particularly comfy couches. We only use small plastic. The speculums are little instruments used to open the vagina while we do the examination. We only use small plastic ones of those, and we warm up the gel a little bit, and we keep it as quick and as non-invasive as possible. And that examination, the whole point is for me to get an idea of how strong the pelvic floor muscles are. If any urine leaks out when a woman coughs, I'll ask her to cough as part of that examination. And to see if any bit of the front or the back of the vaginal wall come down, or whether the uterus itself is coming down. So really we're looking at the strength of the pelvic floor muscles, whether there's any evidence of any stress incontinence, that coughing or producing any leak, and whether there's any prolapse, any of the organs coming downwards.
Dr. Tracy Sims is with us today. She's the lead physician at Cornish Hospital Aesthetic Clinic in Abu Dhabi.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Joining us live on the line to answer my questions, but most importantly yours, around pelvic floor and incontinence, is Dr. Tracy Sims. She's the lead physician at Cornish Hospital Aesthetic Clinic there in Abu Dhabi. We've just been talking there about getting a diagnosis and what happens during that initial consultation. I'm sure a lot of women, and indeed men that you work with, come to you with a huge amount of hope that things are going to change for the better. And it's obviously going to change, depend rather, a huge amount on the severity of their level of incontinence and also the type of incontinence they want. But when it comes to treatment, I wondered if you could give us a quick rundown of what some of the options that are available to patients here in the UAE, Tracy.
Okay, well, the great thing is that actually there is quite a wide range of treatments that patients can benefit from, a number of which are directly under their own control, which is great news. So if we're talking about the pelvic floor and the pelvic floor weakness that's causing the bladder neck to be less well supported and pulling on the urethra less, so stress incontinence, then we're talking about needing to strengthen up those pelvic floor muscles. And one of the things that we can do is we can offer really good advice and education on pelvic floor exercises. We also have physiotherapists, which can help to train women to do the pelvic floor exercises, and also in conjunction with that, use neurostimulation devices and biofeedback devices to help. Because quite often when you start with quite a weak pelvic floor, it's difficult to feel if you're doing the exercises well or correctly. So it can be quite difficult to kind of get yourself off the ground with the pelvic floor exercises. There are also other devices which women can use at home, biofeedback devices, weights that one can use to help you to do the pelvic floor exercises effectively. And then we have the more high-tech devices, such as something called HIFEM, which is high intensity focused electromagnetic pelvic floor strengthening, which is a chair-like device. And we offer this in sets of usually about six sessions. Each session is about 28 minutes long. And a woman comes and sits on the chair. And what's really quite amazing about this device is that whilst a woman's sitting on the chair, their pelvic floor is stimulated to do between 11,200 and 12,000 supramaximal, so extra big, pelvic floor exercises per 28 minute session.
Wow.
So it's really powerful muscle stimulation, and that can often be a really good way of getting the pelvic floor muscle strengthening started, so that women start to see immediate, very fast results, and then they can build on those results with pelvic floor exercises at home.
It must be hugely rewarding for you, Dr. Tracy, because presumably this can be life-changing for a lot of patients, you know, being worried about exercising, coughing, being in unfamiliar situations where there might not be a bathroom. And that, I'm sure that social anxiety feeds into an awful lot of the worries around incontinence. So incredible work. I want to go to the text line. We have had a number of messages on this. And Jem, I'm glad you asked this, Jem. Jem's saying, I've heard Botox can be useful. is that true? Can Botox be useful for an overactive bladder, she's asking?
Yeah. Overactive bladder is the condition where the bladder is a little bit too sensitive, as it were, and it starts to contract and give you the sensation that you want to void, you want to pass urine, when actually there's only small volumes of urine in the bladder. And Botox can therefore be used into the muscle on the back of the bladder to try and relax that muscle and to enable the bladder to tolerate filling to greater levels before it starts to contract and tell you that you want to void. So Botox is indeed a therapy which can be used in some cases for women who have, or men who have, urge incontinence, usually women actually, who have urge incontinence.
Thank you for that. What about as we get older, incontinence in the menopause and any medications around that? Because presumably that's quite a different situation that you're looking at addressing.
Yeah, so as one goes towards the menopause and beyond, we have a natural attenuation of muscles. So all of our muscles have a tendency to become weaker as we age. And of course, the pelvic floor is skeletal muscle, like any of our other muscles on our arms and our legs. And so we do see an increase in urinary incontinence happening around and beyond the menopause. We can still use similar techniques. So we can use the techniques of pelvic floor muscle strengthening. We can definitely use the high intensity focused electromagnetic pelvic floor strengthening, physiotherapy. For the urge component of the incontinence, we can use something called bladder training. And bladder training is when we encourage the bladder very, very gently and very slowly to tolerate holding slightly more urine. So we work with women to perhaps when they get that first urge of wanting to pass urine, thinking, okay, can I just delay that for a minute or two, and gradually build on that to get the bladder to tolerate larger volumes. And then building on the bladder training, we can then perhaps think about some medications, some anticholinergics, for example. There is a whole group of medications that we can use to help to calm down the muscle of the bladder. And what's great about this situation is that we can also use combinations of these treatments. Mm-hmm. So some patients may benefit from a mixture of pelvic floor strengthening, bladder training, plus or minus medication, to really get their difficulties under control and to start giving them the confidence back and the independence to be able to go out, to go to the mall, to go out on car journeys where they don't necessarily have access to a bathroom all of the time.
Dr. Tracy, last question. For anyone who might not be suffering from incontinence now but might be concerned about preventing it in the future, is there anything you'd recommend everyone listening today, male or female, to use for some good pelvic floor health? Are you going to get the UA squeezing right now?
Absolutely, absolutely. I firmly believe that historically we only start thinking about the pelvic floor when it becomes weak, when it becomes a problem. We need to start thinking about the pelvic floor earlier, thinking about the pelvic floor perhaps around the time of puberty, before we've even considered the possibility of having children at some point in our lives. And what we need to be doing is doing the Kegel exercises, the pelvic floor exercises, aiming for 10 long holds and 10 short holds at least 4 times every day. You know, one of the analogies I sometimes use with patients is we would never consider not brushing our teeth at least twice a day. Our pelvic floor exercises need to be as automatic to us as brushing our teeth. We need to find ways of incorporating them into our daily routine so that they're not a chore, they're just part of what we do, like cleaning our teeth. You know, we do this every single day, so we can do the pelvic floor muscle exercises every single day when we're pregnant, when we're not pregnant. And it's really important to keep that pelvic floor muscle strong. And when it's strong to start with, we can feel the exercise. We can get those exercises going so that we know when it's getting weaker and we have to ramp up the exercises or seek more medical advice.
Dr. Tracy, thank you so much for shining a light on something that is very rarely talked about. And I think it's so, so crucial. You can be found, as I said, at Cornish Hospital in the aesthetic clinic as lead physician. Thank you for all the work you do. Thank you for the insights this afternoon. And if anyone wants Dr. Tracy's details, just send me the word doctor. I'd be very happy to send you a link. And you can indeed investigate any help that you might need.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis or treatment.
We are talking kids' performances, whether that is being on stage themselves or indeed seeing some talent. We're marking 10 years of the Courtyard Playhouse, somewhere that I think is such an important, heartfelt part of the UAE. It's there in the courtyard, there in Alkhaz, and 10 years. So what happens there? What can you be getting involved in? And indeed, we're speaking to some of the stars now. Rushdie and Salman are with us. They're instructors as well as performers. I've seen you guys on stage, so it's nice to have you here on my stage. How are you?
Hi, Helen. Thanks. Thanks for that really nice intro.
I really mean this.
I'm still blushing.
Oh, you. I really do mean it. I think for anyone that hasn't been, you walk through the door for the first time and you're like, oh my goodness, this is just, first of all, a gem of a place. It's so different.
Yeah.
And then the vibe, the community, what I've seen with my own kids coming to courses with you, feeling hesitant, and then suddenly the end of week performance. It's so incredible for me as a parent. I can only imagine what it's like for you as instructors. I want to hear a little bit about your own stories first. Salman, you grew up in the Middle East. When did you get the performing bug?
I think I always loved. I was one of those kids that my parents like pushed in parties and go, "Hey, impersonate this person."
Or crikey.
I know. I look back at it and go, "Why?" But I think it helped fuel this desire to entertain or have fun, and got me involved into comedy. I think that was the first kicker for me.
And now, as I said, you I've seen you on improv nights. You do stand up. You're there as an instructor as well. And Rushdie, or as my kids know you as Rusty. You are there at the theatre an awful lot and spend so much time with these kids and really bring them on. What kind of, I don't want to say transformations, but maybe that is what I mean. Have you seen when it comes to kids' confidence on stage?
100%, because, I mean, whether it comes to the camps, which are very intense, or the term, which is over about 10 to 12 weeks, you see the from the first session, they're very afraid to give their own ideas, their own expressions, their own characters. Mm-hmm. By week 12, I'm kind of holding them back going, okay, please calm down.
Yeah, I have to add something to that. The first time I ran a kid's improv class, at the showcase, they took over. They basically sidelined me and took over, and these were shy kids that transformed into that. And I'll never forget it because the parents just looked at me and laughed. They enjoyed it quite a bit.
What I find interesting is sometimes we were talking about shy and quiet kids on the show yesterday with a parenting coach, and Coach Mace was saying, you know, it's about us changing our perception that sometimes these shy and quiet kids are actually very confident and self-contained. They just aren't outgoing. But there are some kids that really do need a bit of a confidence boost in communicating and, you know, expressing themselves. So I feel like there's a bit of a trap that people fall into when it gets kids into performing. And it does tend to be the really extroverted kids who can end up there. But sometimes there must be children who really need it more than others. And I wondered if you could perhaps speak to some of the skills that are developed through the camps and the courses.
Just on exactly what you said, there are a lot of experienced, knowledgeable, great performers who are massively introverted. So on a platform like improv or even drama, in drama you would get your dialogues, you know when your role is, you know when to step in. The beauty of improv is you do not get told it's your time to speak. Mm-hmm. So if it's training, if you're in a class, especially with the kids, everyone's screaming high energy. They've saved it up for that session. Usually I say, and Sal has taught me this, it's who hasn't spoken yet? Who hasn't raised their hand? Who hasn't? And the kids look around and they don't remember. But there is one kid who slowly raises their hand and I say, how did it feel? And she's like, I wanted to get in, but I didn't. I let that person. And then all the other kids go, oh, okay, we didn't realize. The next time, they always look in and check in with her.
That's interesting. So it's confidence, but it's also an emotional intelligence.
100%.
And awareness. Yeah.
I think also a lot of the exercises, because it's a collaborative art form, mm-hmm. a lot of the exercises are designed to have kids create that space where both persons involved in the exercise have to contribute. So it's learning to share, right? And you have that extrovert kid, the confident kid, who will try to overstep a little bit. But these exercises are great because essentially you fail if you don't share. Mm-hmm. And so they have to learn to bring out
make
space. And and in return, your shy kid has to go, I have to step up.
Yeah, I'm going to meet you in the middle somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are you doing to mark 10 years of the Courtyard Playhouse, Rushdie?
Honestly, we are doing everything. I don't think there's more we can do because Kemsley Dickinson, the owner, as the years have gone by, he has something that I love, which is a thought, an ethos of we don't repeat, we don't rinse and repeat, we keep improving. Something we loved that no longer works, we're going to change it up, we're going to challenge ourselves, and we're going to bring that nervousness and that surprise back to the audience as well as ourselves, because as improvisers, we want to inspire each other. And Sal's been here 10 years. He's still being inspired and, of course, inspiring. And so we have an example. We have 5 kids shows that we have on. We have 5 evening programs for the adults. So naming some of the few for the kids. The most simple is What Comes Next. In one line, a show where the performers get on and they ask the kids what happens next. So the kids, completely brutally honest, as we all know,
there
they say
honest critics in the world.
There is no limit to how
we accept their ideas as they come in, and they can see this is what I love about that show. They can see cause and effect. Yeah. So they say, "Hey, we want the villain to do this. We'll do it," and then they can see what impact it has on the story. I think it's very powerful as well. Because it evens out the audience, because the kids will first have a little bit of fun, but they'll go, "Oh no, this destroyed this." They did it, and this is what's happened to the story and the character. So let's reel back.
An example is the kids also build our set. So if they say, "You go to a castle," we're like, "All right, kids, we don't know how to build one. Can you help us?" And then we put on this fun music, and they're building it themselves, much like large pieces of Legos. And then imagine the next scene. They say, "Destroy the castle." And you see their hearts break. But we're also like, "You did this."
I mean, I think you're on the nose there. When we've been to see some of your shows, and The Toilet Monster, and My Kids Are Superhero, and there's been little darlings I absolutely adore. There is something so amazing about being in the car with the kids on the way home, like, "He took my idea."
Yeah.
I shouted that, and that was the character name.
Exactly.
And like, to think that you can create something in front of you in real time when you're 6 years old is so cool.
It is. And I think at the end, if we forget sometimes, we always say, "This was your story, your creation. Thank you."
I remember once the kid said, I was the evil character because I just like those characters. And I was still trying to be nice, trying to test the kids' moral grounds, like the moral dilemmas. That's what we call them. And that's very important, because you can say, "Beat that person, arrest that person, do this, close that person off." But I'm asking for forgiveness. An example, a big thing kids go through as well when they make mistakes, and we always ask the same question: have you ever done something wrong? Have your parents forgiven you? They're like, "Yes, but one time." The kid said, take him to prison. And then I said, no, but I, and then everyone dragged me off, and all the kids were like, "Oh no, they're actually doing it.
Consequences."
Yeah, it's happening. And then we asked them, we're not supposed to do this, but I said, do you kids want to rewind? And they said, "You rewind." And we went, "What?" And then again, I asked for forgiveness, and they're like, "Okay, fine."
But it is. It's a safe space to try out some big themes and big ideas, and talking about morals and role playing out some scenarios, and like Little Darlings, for example, where you're looking at that classic formula of a Roald Dahl book. There is a villain.
Yes.
There is this back and forth between good and evil, and it really does make kids think. Got a question here from Irina saying, "Do they do public speaking?" Interesting. Do you do public speaking for kids as
Yes,
well?
We do. 8 to 11s. And it's funny you ask us, because we've just recently started. So it's been 2 terms in. And every course that's created has a syllabus in mind and is developed. Mm-hmm. So at this stage, we have an even better public speaking course. And we also ask, why is this for a specific purpose? So is it for drama, or is it literally for just getting on stage and, presenting an idea? Yeah.
Can I just add the instructor for that, Alana? She comes from a drama background. She's amazing. And this isn't a sales pitch or whatever. She's really, I genuinely love her.
You have good people. And I really, really mean that.
I'm going to drop the mic here and walk off into the sunset.
No, but truthfully, they've done an amazing job over the last 10 years in terms of developing your talent, but also connecting kids and, adults with improv and entertainment, those screenings. We run out of time.
Oh,
but what I would say is you need to get over to the Instagram, the website, because there's so much planned. It's the Kids Theatre Festival. You can get a week-long pass. We're going to be there for sure. Guys, thank you so, so much for everything you do. I think it's been
an
incredible accomplishment for the last 10 years. And I think the more the community can get behind a community theatre, the more we're going to get more out of it. So cannot praise you enough. If you want details of the courses, the classes, send me the word theatre. I will happily send you a link, and I will see you there in Alcoz. UK TV presenter Eamon Holmes recently described his experience with shingles and called the pain excruciating. It was caused by the chicken pox virus. He also stated that there are so many misconceptions about the disease and the complete lack of awareness about the symptoms that We thought that we would do our bit to shine a light on it with both a doctor and indeed a patient. Dr. Ahmed Sabdi joining us. He is a consultant in infectious diseases at the Al Qasimi Hospital in Sharjah. And we have got in the studio Douglas Korth, who has been suffering from this for a while. So I just want to be, well, first of all, say a huge thank you to both of you for your time. Dr. Ahmed, how are you?
How are you? Hi, Helen.
Great to have you with us. We're going to be coming to you for some advice very soon indeed. First, I want to hear from Douglas a little bit about your experiences. And I am very much in that group of people who don't know an awful lot about shingles. So did you know what it was when you got it?
I had no idea what I was dealing with.
Tell us a little bit about when you first realized that something was up health-wise. What were some of the symptoms that kind of alerted you?
Yeah, I started out with a headache and just generally feeling really tired and just worn out and achy on my body. Mm-hmm. Just thought it was flu or something like that, but it obviously it turned out to be something different.
So let's, and I think, and to other doctors apart from Dr. Ahmed, forgive me, I think an awful lot of people go around the houses a little bit trying to get a correct diagnosis before they actually work out what they're dealing with. What were you hearing from some people in your quest to feel better?
Helen, I was so fortunate, and I am so fortunate. My wife is a doctor, and she recognized immediately what it was. So that diagnosis process took all of maybe 8 hours when I woke up the next morning, and she looked at me and goes, I know what you've got.
How interesting. See, in my mind, I think of shingles, and forgive me, I think of it being in almost like a group of infectious diseases or illnesses that are from like years ago. I think of it as being like croup or scarlet fever, something like a Victorian chimney sweep might have. I don't think of it as being like a current condition. And I think it's really important to talk about just actually how many people are struggling with it, often without knowing about it. So tell us a little bit about some of those symptoms that you were suffering from. Because as I said earlier, chickenpox virus connection there. Did you have any kind of skin rashes or any kind of dermatological complaints?
The skin rashes, they started a little bit later on. So, but initially it was just headache and just feeling really tired, worn out and achy. But then it quickly progressed to literally the next morning, started having rash and a bit of almost like an acne breaking out on my face. I had it on the left-hand side of my face. And then it just got worse and worse until you had scabbing and some lesions and things on your face as it progressed.
And how long did this go on for, Douglas?
This went on, you know, after it really kicked in, it went on for about 7 days. It was about a week-long endeavor of excitement of just looking terrible and feeling even worse because the intense pain that comes with the virus that is attacking the nerves.
So, treatment. Talk to us about some of the options that were available to you and how long it took to actually work.
Yeah, there aren't too many options available from what my wife explained to me is really it's just nerve blocking medication such that when it reduces the pain, impulses coming from the nerves. Mm-hmm. And that's about what you can do. You can't kill the virus. Of course, you can take some other, you know, viral blockers, but it doesn't kill it. Just kind of suppresses it until your own immune system takes over and pushes it aside.
Can you trace back then and get an understanding of why or how you got it, about that causation?
So my understanding is that that chickenpox virus that we had as kids, it resides in our nervous system for the rest of our lives. It never goes away. And what triggers it is when your body is, you're either really stressed or you just immunosuppressed. Mm-hmm. And that could be just worn out, fatigued, tired. Just there's multiple things that would do that to your body and you really have no control and you can't predict it. And it just happens.
So it flares up.
It just happens.
So how long ago was this, Douglas?
This was about 8 years ago.
And how are you feeling today? Have you had any recurrences?
Thankfully, no. Because I do understand also that it comes back. You know, in the absence of any kind of vaccine, it can come back. But thankfully, I haven't had any reoccurrences, and I certainly wouldn't want to.
We're going to be talking next, as I said, to Dr. Ahmed, speaking to us from Al Qasimi Hospital in Sharjah. He's a consultant in infectious diseases. Douglas, thank you for being with us. Really, really appreciate your time today. We're going to be finding out next about some of those risk factors. Can anyone get it at any age? And do you have to have had chicken pox first? That's coming your way. We're having a bit of a health special on the show today. Studies show that 30% of people will get shingles at some point in their life. But what exactly is it and what can treatment look like? Let's ask the expert. Dr. Ahmed Subdi is joining us, a consultant in infectious diseases at the Al-Qasimi Hospital in Sharjah. We've also got messages coming in on the text line for you, Dr. Ahmed. We just heard from Douglas there who really struggled with it and luckily managed to get a diagnosis quickly thanks to his doctor wife. Are you able to tell us, if you don't mind, a little bit about what exactly shingles is in the body and what can happen?
Sure, Helen. Thank you for having me. I was enjoying listening to Douglas and sharing his experience. Now, shingles basically is a viral disease called the varicella or the herpes zoster virus. And this is basically something that you acquire or you get infected with during your childhood or early adulthood. And they call it, when you were a child and you get that disease, they call it chickenpox.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is this virus does not leave our body. It stays inactive or latent in the nerve root. And anytime during your life, there is a chance that this virus gets reactivated mm-hmm. or you get a flare-up of the symptoms. When you have this recurrent flare-up, they call it shingles. And you can get it maybe once a month, once a year, once every 10 years. It depends on two or three more things that you have to take into consideration. Your immune system, mm-hmm. your social life, and how much stress you are exposed to.
Mm-hmm.
So these are basically the main risk factors that could increase the chance of getting the flare-up of the shingles or the zoster virus.
Goodness me. So it can be very much a reoccurrence. And actually, Douglas alluded to that as well in terms of, you know, what feeling run down. And this was when it struck. And we are just starting to see, you know, more and more data around just how much reduced sleep can have on your immune system. What about age or any other factors in terms of health?
Absolutely. Now, age by itself is a risk factor to get the flare-up of the shingles. Now, besides the age, some other medical conditions or comorbidities could increase the risk or the chance of the flare-up of the shingles.
Mm-hmm.
If you have any kind of illness that could lower your immune system, that by itself is a risk factor to get the flare-up of the shingles. Whether you are a patient who has a cancer, patient who's getting biological treatment
mm-hmm.
for other diseases, you are someone who has an organ transplant, and many other conditions. So a lot of things that could increase the chance of the flare-up. And again, nobody can predict how frequent you're going to get this flare-up. Something might happen once every while, some other people, they might have it once a year or so.
And let's talk symptoms. Douglas explaining that, you know, blinding headache, real fatigue, and then that rash on his face in that situation becoming lesions. Can you explain a little bit about some of those symptoms that perhaps he didn't experience or some that are lesser known as well, just to help as many people as possible this afternoon, Dr. Ahmed?
Absolutely. Now, as Douglas, what he said, it's exactly the classical way or the presentation of the shingles. Initially, the patient suffering from flu-like symptoms, low-grade fever, headache, fatigue, tiredness. Later on, after a few days, patient will start seeing the rash or the vesicles that in certain part of his skin. So the reason why that you don't get an early diagnosis, because you really, what you get initially is just vague symptoms that these symptoms are similar to any other type of flu or other viral infection.
Mm-hmm.
By the time you will get the shingles and you start thinking about the shingles as a diagnosis, you seek the medical help, you go to your doctor, maybe you're beyond the window where the medications that can help a lot or add something to your management and the outcome. That's why a lot of patients, when they go with a late diagnosis, by that time, even if there is medication that is available, it's not going to be as effective as it's something that was offered to the patient earlier.
That first time.
But the problem is mm-hmm. the diagnosis is late in most of the time because of the vague symptoms that the patient initially suffering from.
Let's go to the text line. Dr. Ahmed, message here from Lisa saying, my 86-year-old mum has come down with shingles and it's her fourth week battling the virus. We're using Panadol to treat the pain, calamine lotion for the rash. But is there anything else we could do to be giving her greater relief? Many thanks.
Yeah, unfortunately, the long-term complications or suffering from the shingles, you don't have that many tools that you can use to help the patient with their post-shingles symptoms. Besides what we mentioned earlier about the initial symptoms and the patient start experiencing the rash, the most important complication that most of the patients are suffering from, what they call it, the post-herpes or post-shingles nerve pain. They call it post-herpetic neuralgia or nerve pain. This is something that most of the patients are suffering from, and this post-herpes or post-shingles nerve pain could last for weeks or months sometimes, and really affecting the patient's daily activity. Mm-hmm. Patient cannot sit, cannot sleep, cannot interact, cannot work. So a lot of daily activities get affected by this post-shingles nerve pain.
A message here, no name in it, and as I always say, it's absolutely fine to be anonymous on the text line. We don't mind a bit. I'm asking, is it contagious? We know chickenpox is. What about shingles?
Same thing. Well, as long as you have the active lesions or the vesicles, you are contagious. And someone who comes in direct contact with the patient, there is a chance that they can acquire the virus if they were not infected with the chickenpox during their childhood. Because remember, most of the people, maybe they had the chickenpox during the childhood or early adulthood, but those people who they did not have the herpes zoster virus, mm-hmm. the chickenpox virus during their childhood, if they come in direct contact with someone with shingles, they have the chance of getting infected by the direct contact to that person.
Last question, Dr. Ahmed, I wanted to ask you about staying in good health and, I guess, preventing shingles. Obviously, you can only do what you can do, but is it going to be those lifestyle factors, making sure you are well-rested, you know, you've got good levels of, you know, your B12 and your vitamin D and you avoid stress, or is there anything else that you'd recommend as an expert in infectious diseases?
Yes, staying in a good health is one thing. Watch your diet and watch what you eat is helping. Stay away from the stress is helping. But sometimes some of the risk factors, really you cannot avoid them. Mm-hmm. The problem is with the shingles, even the routine social daily stress or job stress or financial stress could be enough to trigger or activate that shingles. So the best thing that nowadays we are talking about shingles maybe more than few years back, because we have people who they live longer, we have people who they receive medications that could lower their immune system for other reasons that those medications were not available many years back. Mm-hmm. And definitely nowadays, maybe there is some other tools that you can use as preventive measures. They were not available maybe 5 or 10 years back. So I advise people who they have a contact with their doctor to share their experience and to discuss with their doctors what options are available as a preventive measures for shingles.
Thank you so much for your time today. Really do appreciate it. Dr. Ahmed speaking to us there from Al Qasim Hospital in Sharjah, where he's a consultant in infectious diseases. Thank you again to Douglas for coming in and sharing his story. If you'd like us to raise awareness around any condition that you've experienced or is in your family, in your life, get in touch equally. If there's anything, any doctors out there that you think would be a brilliant addition to Dubai Eye, we'd love to hear from you.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Missing moggies and dogs on the run. Well, we might have a solution for that. We've got the co-founders of Where My Paws At. We've got Carly and Nick in the studio to tell us a little bit about their business and the problems that they're looking to solve through it. Carly, regular listeners of Pets and Vets on a Wednesday afternoon will know that I love to hear about the pets in people's lives. I like to know breeds. I like to know names. So tell us about your menagerie, your furry friends.
Yeah, sure. So we have two dogs and two cats. we have a little Frenchie, we have an English bulldog, and then we have two rescue cats. We've got a little Persian, and we've also got a street cat that we rescued from Qatar.
Okay, give me names.
So we've got Frank the Frenchie, we've got Lola the British bulldog, and then Moo our Persian, and Bruce the street cat.
Now, given that we're talking about pets going missing, and I sincerely hope this is an upsetting thing, have any of the pets actually gone missing, Carly?
Yes, they have, yeah.
Can you tell us what happened?
Sure. So Moo went missing probably around 5 years ago now, and that's how we thought of the idea of Where My Paws At. So we had a few friends over from the UK. They'd accidentally left one of the doors open and he snuck out. So
it was indoor cat or outdoor cat?
Indoor cat, yeah. And it was very late at night, so we weren't able to knock on neighbours' doors. Obviously, we started looking for him straight away. Mm-hmm. And after a very sleepless night, we woke up the next morning and we put some pet flyers, printed some pet flyers off, put them around the community. And thankfully, one lady saw the posters and started to help look for Moo. And we found him, thankfully, 3 days later.
3 days, though. Mm-hmm. I've had friends with cats go missing and they've come back in terrible state, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because especially with indoor cats, you know, they're not the street savvy. No. You know, at all. Was he all right when you came back?
He was very dehydrated, very scared. But yeah, thankfully he was okay. He wasn't injured. So it kind of got us thinking that there was nothing in Dubai at the time to help you in that situation. And I think it's really important for people to know as well that there's no central microchip database in the UAE. So in the event that your pet goes missing and is taken to a vet where they're not registered, it's really difficult then for that vet to identify mm-hmm. the animal and also contact you. So we've come up with a central platform on the app, and every dog and cat parent can use that as a free user. It's free for everyone to use. And you create a pet profile. So on the pet profile, we ask for things like, first of all, do you have a dog or a cat? Then we ask for breeds, colour, a picture, any unique markings. Most importantly, that microchip number mm-hmm. and also which vet you're registered with. So we give vets free access to the app to be able to check microchips. So when an animal is taken into them and they're scanned for a microchip number, they can then put that number into our app. And if you're registered with us, it will immediately match and bring up that profile where they can then contact you directly. And they can also see which vet that animal is registered with.
Wow. Can I ask, and I should know the answer to this, and I apologise, do all pets need to be microchipped here? Is that a requirement to get a municipality tag, or is it simply a nice to have?
It's by law, the UAE law is to have your pet microchipped, yes.
But as you say, the missing piece has been that communication.
Yeah.
Because if, as you said, if, and you know, who knows, you've heard of cats around the world going missing and turning up, you know, 80 kilometres down the road. So if that pet is then taken to a vet where they're not registered, it's just an echoing silence. So
exactly.
you're connecting those dots there,
yes,
as well.
Yes, we are. And I think a really important thing to say is with our app, it's so easy to edit your information. So if you change address, you change mobile numbers, it's so easy to update on the app and it's instant as well.
What other services are you offering in terms of, I guess, getting the word out should the worst happen?
So as a free user, you will also receive missing notifications. So if a pet goes missing in your community, our app will ping you an alert to say this animal's missing, where you can see the pet profile. Then we have premium features. So part of the premium features, we have the lost alerts. And the lost alerts, you will bring up your pet profile. There's a button that you press and it's an instant alert that gets sent out to the community. So the first alert that's sent out is 10K radius. And then on day two, it's sent out to 20K radius. On day three, it's sent out to 40K. On day seven, it gets sent out to 50K. And then day 12, it gets sent out to 50K again. As well as the lost alerts, we also have an auto-generated missing pet flyer that is created through the app.
That's amazing. Rather than me, that's my really shonky Photoshop skills.
So you can create that in under 30 seconds. You can send that out, then share it on social media, on email, on WhatsApp. You can save it as a PDF and print out. And then we have our discounts as well. So we know how expensive it can be being a pet parent. Mm-hmm. We have groomers on our app. We have pet food and accessories. We have daycare and boarding. And we also have some F&B dog-friendly restaurants.
I'll take that all day long. You're also doing some tags.
We are. Yeah, we
this
are.
This is what I need. So we've got two dogs, and Lucy in particular. She has tendencies, shall we say. She sees an open gate and she's like, yes, my taste of freedom. She doesn't do anything when she gets out. She kind of plonks her bum down. But my heart just, you know, mm-hmm. you can imagine. So how does that work? Is it just something that can go onto their collar?
Yeah, their collar or the harness. I think it's really important, Helen, to mention that a pet tag, whether it's one of ours or an engraved one, it's really important. And it's the easiest way to identify yeah. an animal, right? So we're not reinventing the wheel with our smart pet tags. We're unique in the sense that our app is only UAE-based. So it's a UAE-based community. We have two tags available at the moment, one in pink and one in blue. And each tag has a unique QR code on the back that links to your pet profile. So if someone was to find your animal wearing one of our tags, they don't need the app. Mm-hmm. They just need a camera phone to scan the QR code. That will then bring up the pet profile information where they can call you directly. So it's a call function.
So clever.
Thank you. And then as soon as that call function has been pressed, an alert is sent to you as the pet parent to say that your tag has been scanned. And then we send you the GPS location as well by email.
I've had a lot of messages, one saying this sounds amazing. Natalie saying, what is it called? You've had a message from Sophie saying, I just want to let my friend Sophie know how amazing she is. All of her friends and family are so proud of her for everything she's doing with Where My Paws At, but also for being such a special person. I'm so grateful for her. So pet community and your friends behind you on this one. So awesome. Huge congratulations.
Thank you.
Tell us then, where can people find out more, download that app
sure.
and be part of a community, which sounds like, you know, has been needed for a long time, Carly.
Yeah. So we're called Where My Paws At. You can visit our website, wheremypawsat.com, and we are available to download on both app stores, Where My Paws At.
Thank you so much. If anyone wants that link, I'll make it super easy for you. You can just send me the word paw, P-A-W. I'll send you the link and you can head on over there. Really appreciate your time, guys. Thank you so, so much. I'm going to get on it immediately. We're talking about how you can stay active and healthy during Ramadan now with Hania Mahmoud, aka Healthy Hania. She's an award-winning holistic weight loss coach, certified personal trainer. And Ramadan Mubarak to you. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you, Helen.
Thank you for being with us and shedding some of your insights and answering questions as well. We're very happy to take any messages that come in on 4001. I've already had a couple on my social media as well. Outside of Ramadan, tell us a little bit about the work that you do with women in particular, because as I said, it's about holistic weight loss. What does that actually mean to you?
Okay, so holistic weight loss is very different from like the mainstream fitness industry, which is very much calorie counting and how much you're burning via exercise and eating. And it's like this addition and subtraction like equations. Holistic weight loss takes into account your mind, body, and soul, because it's stems from the belief that we need all three to be complete and to be balanced. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense, because you might see somebody whose maybe appearance looks a certain way, which is attractive, but then the mind might be completely, you know, like very toxic thought patterns. So there's really no point in that either. So it's really taking account your the way you see yourself, the way you see food, the way you, you know, enjoying your life, like, exercise is, that's what I always say, like, when people ask me what exercise to do, my first question is like, what do you like to do? Like, mm-hmm. let's start off with that, because it doesn't matter what I like or what XYZ is going to recommend, unless you find some kind of joy in do. And then, and it's a tough one, because we're so like brainwashed in like, we have to do like HIIT, or I have to do this.
Totally. And I think there's an awful lot of kind of, and I would like to point the finger at Mr. Graham, who was our PE teacher, who made PE classes at school absolutely miserable. And I really mean that. He was a really unpleasant man. And for a long time, I kind of thought that exercise was punishment. That wasn't a conscious you know, connection that I'd made in my mind. But that was it. You know, that was, it was something that you had to endure. And then, you know, as I'm sure most women and probably many men listening today, exercise became something that I had to do in order to try and make my body look a certain way.
I have exactly the same experience with PE teachers. I don't know if it's a thing from like the 80s or 90s.
I was just about to say, my kids' PE teachers are amazing now. Shout out to them. But maybe it worked. Maybe it attracted a certain type in the 80s.
I have that kind of trauma as well, like 100%. And I still remember comparing myself to the girls who were like so agile and so good. And I felt like a big blob, like I couldn't, you know. And I still, when I think back and reconnect, I feel really sad for myself. And I'm like, oh my God. Like, nobody told me that it's okay not to be perfect at this and you can do something else instead.
Yeah, I know. And it's only really, I guess I'm 40 now, in the last kind of 5 years that I've become, I'm more into being active, I guess. I mean, I love classes. I go spinning, you know, a few times a week. I love that. You know, got into hiking because of COVID and found, you know, Wadi Shalka and ended up climbing mountains. And that, like, that's become something that I get a huge amount of, you know, to borrow your word, joy from. But I think a lot of people, and I was a big part of this group, get incredibly anxious about exercise, about going into a gym or a class for the first time. And that's something that not a lot of people in the fitness industry understand, and they probably should.
Yeah, yeah. But the great thing is, Helen, is that now we have, there's so much that you can do without putting yourself in that situation.
Totally.
If you're not really into that. Like, there's just so much content online as well, which I would say you have to sort of know how to navigate it, because you don't want to do something that would hurt you. But and it doesn't have to be like strenuous, you know, like I'm sweating buckets. You know, that doesn't mean, that's not an indication of a good workout, because you might actually be putting too much stress on yourself if you're doing a lot of that kind of cardio. So not to say that it's bad, but things like belly dancing, like that's a big thing, like these kind of dance lessons, like they're actually quite, can be fun for some people. So that would be something I'd explore, recommend.
I think that's exactly right. We think about exercise and people immediately go, okay, it's going to be, you know, beast mode and burpees in the gym. It's not. It can be, and if they enjoy that, power to you. I mean, I'd be a bit suspicious of anyone that genuinely enjoys doing burpees, but that's just me. Sometimes it's just about moving, and that can be, you know, a walk on the beach track with a friend and having a good gossip. Healthy Hania is with us today. She is an award-winning holistic weight loss coach, a certified personal trainer. And we're talking about not necessarily getting healthy, but perhaps staying healthy during Ramadan. And I wanted to ask you about what can some realistic goals be at this time? And have you got any kind of do's and don'ts that you pass on to your clients?
Yeah. So in terms of exercise, I just want to share like the general guidelines that are given is about 150 minutes of moderate intensity exercise. We're looking at like cardio type stuff or like brisk walking, that kind of zone.
This is per week. Please don't say per day.
Per week.
Phew.
I mean, I'm sure there's some who do per day, but not me.
Not
that's
me.
For sure. So I'm just saying from a general point of view, we're looking at that. Or if you're doing high intensity, then it would be like 75 minutes a week. This is just a very generic sort of thing for adults. Like everybody is different. Everybody has a different starting point. That's what I always say. Like my question is like, what is your starting point? So if we're looking at somebody who is regularly exercising like 3, 4, 5 times a week, then they could probably maintain that kind of rhythm to some extent. I always say reduce your intensity. Like Ramadan is not to hit your next, it's not your your training zone to hit your next marathon, you know, your limits and whatever. It's about keeping, you know, keeping your muscle mass, keeping your circulation going, because we do have a tendency to be, so when you reduce your food intake, you have this natural instinct to actually move less. And so you don't realize that, but you're probably spending more hours sitting than you usually would. So it's really important from that point of view, if you can just even get walking a little bit. It doesn't have to be long walks, but just not even for weight loss, just for your system to get going and not be in that like lethargy sort of thing. Because the first 2 days of Ramadan are a bit like, you feel a bit blah, like, you know, then you get used to it, and your body feels lighter, but it can be a bit of a challenge in the beginning. So if you have a pattern and an experience, like if you have history with exercising, like, you know, moderate, then I would say you know, keep it going 3-4 times a week, but just cut the intensity by half.
And this probably isn't the time to be starting a new exercise regime.
No way. Like, you know, okay, I'm going to say this with caution, but like you've been here for over a decade, Helen, and you know how important this is for in this part of the world, this practice. And there are people who literally, even maybe sometimes doctors tell them don't fast. They have like XYZ disorders and they still really want to do it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I always say like for people like that, don't exercise because that's going to put a bit more stress on your body, you know, so those kind of cases. So I can't say that everybody who is fasting should exercise, but most sort of like general population who are doing okay will benefit from some movement. Like,
and the benefits from that movement presumably can help with energy levels all the way through the day as well.
Yes. You know, my favorite thing to do is, and the thing is, you have to get into that routine, is that to get a quick walk after suhoor. Because you've just eaten something, you know, you've been replenished. I mean, I can't be up even before that. I mean, there's some people might be up at like 3 a.m. for it. Like, it's let me just eat something. And before the kids go to school, if I can manage like a brisk walk, if the weather is really nice, that's my time to like, you know, relax, think of my day, mm-hmm. anything that's, you know, sort of like pressure in my head, release that. It's like my me time and I'm getting that movement. So it's just like a win-win.
Is there any particular time of day where certain types of you get benefits from certain types of exercise, whether that is weight or cardio, you know?
Yeah, in Ramadan specifically. So Ramadan, I would say in general, first of all, if you're going to do any kind of physical activity, I would say do it around the times of like suhoor or iftar. So either you would get in a quick workout or whatever the physical activity is, get that in before breaking your fast or shortly after, because mm-hmm. you have that, it just makes sense. You know, if you're doing it in the middle of the day, again, there are people who do, my husband plays squash in the middle of the day. I don't know how, but there are people who do that, but it might not be a great advice for many because the thing is, when you're working out before breaking your fast, the good thing is that your brain kind of knows that you're going to be rewarded after. So it might be quite okay, like you might feel quite good, even if it's at the end of the day.
Yep. Can I ask about food and, I guess, preparing your body? You get up at, well, actually, if you wouldn't mind kind of telling us a little bit about your routine. So what time you're waking up and what you're eating before the sun comes up?
So I'm getting up at about 4:20, 4:30. And the sun, so just to the nuance, we say like sunrise, but it's actually not the real sunrise. The sun rises at like 6-ish. This is like the break of dawn. So that's actually the time that the fast begins. That these days in Dubai is about 5, like 5:02, like yesterday or something. And so I get up and I'm a bit thirsty usually. I have a few glasses of water, just as much as I'm thirsty. And typically, like this morning, what did I have? I had porridge with some dates cooked in it. And a bit of honey. That's what I have. But sometimes I'll have an omelet with some like whole grain toast. It depends. Like I'm quite flexible. I don't do corn. I don't do cereals. Like I don't even buy cereals. Like they're just, I mean, it's just like another form of sweets, basically, just FYI. So that's not going to take you very long. You want some kind of whole grain in your breakfast.
Some slow release.
Slow release. You got the words.
I know. I know what to do. I just don't do it. I've got all the information. I just don't implement it.
You do. You're looking fantastic.
It's very kind.
Protein is very helpful. It keeps you fuller. It helps support your muscles. So just like, it's okay if you don't have vegetables in the morning, if you don't have fruits, like, no need to like stress yourself out with that. Mm-hmm. The thing I would like to point out is that iftar time, which people culturally, we all tend to do that, is like we mix like 10 different things and eat it like back to back. Like that is just not doing you any favors. And that's no wonder you're going to feel bloated, lethargic, and just feel like a big blow.
I mean, every single year there's a story that comes out from somewhere around the GCC. It's not normally the UAE, about someone who's taken to hospital thinking they're having a heart attack. And it's actually just from having a bucket of chicken and getting indigestion. So yeah, healthy ways to break the fast. Thank you so much. We've run out of time and we have had some messages to get to, but I will connect you with Hania separately. Bilal saying, I just want to say how grateful I am that Ramadan coincides with the school holidays next week. So for more family time, blessings to all. Thank you for that, Bilal. And if anyone wants to contact you, Hania, for a bit of coaching during Ramadan and indeed all year round, what's the best way of getting in touch?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram at Healthy Hania, and I actually have this special offer that I'm doing. It's called RMD 60, a 60-minute like power session with me to like get yourself energized and your goals in line for this Ramadan and beyond.
If you want details of that, send me the word healthy and I will send you the link. Talking money matters now, and the Young Investors competition is back for its second edition. It offers high school students, so those aged 13 to 18, an opportunity to develop practical investment and business skills. Where was this when I was a teenager? And the beauty of this competition, it was actually founded by a teen. Joining us now is the 17-year-old CEO, Dhruv. Thank you so much for being with us. What an amazing achievement. I need to find out more. I've heard, because this is the largest investment competition in Asia, the second largest in the world. How many people have participated in last year's competition, Dhruv?
Hi, I'm really happy to be here. So in our first edition of the Young Investors competition, we boasted around 1,200 participants.
Wow.
And approximately 450 teams.
Oh my goodness. And where? How many countries do you think you were representing?
27.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, obviously, you're here in the UAE, so thank you for speaking with us this afternoon. I want to know, how did you come up with this idea, let alone make it the largest investment competition in Asia?
Right. So this all pretty much started when I was in year 10 and I had the opportunity to choose my own subjects. So considering myself as a business savvy student, I chose business. Now, as I progressed through my curriculum, I learned that our textbooks and our curriculum didn't really teach us much about personal finance, mm-hmm. and how teenagers like us can make use of practical business skills. And that pretty much motivated me to take it upon myself and teach financial literacy to other teenagers like myself.
You realize that majority of people, teenagers or adults, will just go, oh, it's a shame that that's not happening. I think it takes a special someone to go, okay, I'm actually going to action something this. So tell us then, why a competition and what happens in practice?
Right. So essentially, the Young Investors competition is a case competition in which participants will be given a fictional client and they have to pretty much propose an investment strategy, which will be presented to a panel of judges. So this really builds upon, you know, their ability to pitch their strategy, to be able to sell what they're doing and with confidence. Mm-hmm. And throughout their journey, they're going to learn a lot of practical business skills such as stock picking, stock analysis, and evaluating their portfolio.
So they're putting together what they think to be kind of a best case for a fictional investor. And are there any kind of limitations or rules that they need to be aware of?
Right. So in terms of the rules, they're going to have to limit their presentations to 10 slides. Mm-hmm. And if they are to make it to the finals, where they're going to present to a panel of judges, they're going to have to keep their presentations down to 10 minutes maximum.
Okay. All right. And what kind of trends did you notice last year in terms of, you know, businesses or, you know, stocks that the competitors were gravitating towards? Is there anything that, you know, that caught your eye last time?
Right. So I think, you know, being a teenager, we're all really interested in technology.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did notice the trend that most students did end up investigating the technology sector, and with a very little emphasis on, you know, the consumer staples.
Interesting. All right. Now, what was your own financial education like? Because you obviously had enough to recognize that it was missing from the curriculum. Who taught you about money, and where are some of the resources you're continuing that education, Dhruv?
So, yeah. So when I was 12, I asked my dad once what he was doing. And at that time, he was probably researching a stock, I believe. So, you know, he sat me down and he explained to me how, how, you know, he goes about things, and he showed me his portfolio. So at that time, I was, you know, very interested in how businesses, you know, make themselves available for others to purchase. Mm-hmm. And that's when I actually ended up buying my first stock. So it started off as just something that I found appealing. But as I sort of, as time progressed and I started earning a bit, I started actually getting interested in it. So the main person who's actually given me all my sort of financial education was pretty much my dad.
You're so lucky. It feels like there is a real responsibility on parents and certainly outside sources to be educating our kids. We've had a question here saying, is there a prize? That's from William, who's 14. Sounds keen. So tell us then about how to join. Is there a fee to take part? And yeah, let's answer William's question. Is there a prize?
Right. So participants can sign up through our website. It's www.investorscomp.com, .org. And right, so in terms of the prizes, we're giving out about $5,000 in terms of just cash prizes, which will be split amongst the top three teams. And as well as that, we're going to be announcing an internship very soon for the team placing first. And not only that, we have also partnered up with Hale Education, which is a counseling service for, you know, college. Mm-hmm. And what they're doing is they're giving away free sessions through their counseling services to the top three teams who win.
So is there do you have to pay anything to enter? And I guess you can be anywhere in the world. Here, you know, we're here in the UAE. Is it all online?
Yeah, so there's no cost to enter. It's completely free. And participants can participate from anywhere in the world.
So just need to be age 13 to 18. The website is investorscomp.org. So William and indeed any other teens out there who want to head on over, that's where you need to go. You can also just send me the word invest. I'm very happy to send that link your way so you can find out a bit more. And lastly, what would some of your top tips, your insights be to any other young people listening today when it comes to investing and managing money like you do?
Right. So pretty much my biggest tip would be to go to head on to our website where we've actually published the presentations that were done by previous winners. Mm. So there, you know, people should take inspiration and look at how people have evaluated the case and how they've gone about with their approach. Another way would be to visit another partnered website. It's called the Financial Freedom Program. So that it's pretty much an organization that, again, strives to improve financial literacy. So I've actually created a course on the basics of stock market and how you can invest. So they can go ahead and take a look at the contents of the course to sort of get a general and basic idea of how they can approach this competition.
Wow. Are you planning to retire by the age 25? What's your plan?
I don't have any. I really, you know, I'm very passionate about finance. I will definitely be pursuing that until I retire at a much later age. But yeah, for now, I'm just planning to study at university and hopefully pursue a career in investment banking.
Good for you. You've chosen a university yet? Are we going to keep you here in the UAE, or are you going to head off and then bring that brain back here to Dubai?
I'm likely going to do the latter. I'm looking at Wharton at UPenn or NYU Stern.
Well, they'd be lucky to have you. Thank you so much for your time today. Already a number of people getting in touch wanting details of this website. So if you are aged between 13 and 18, or indeed you've got a teen in your life who thinks that they could be winning an incredible competition, I mean, some great expertise, great experience, and yeah, cash prize as well. Send me the word invest. I will send you that link. Dhruv, keep us posted. I'd love to hear some of the ideas of the winners once you've made your selection. Thank you so much for your time, and wishing you all the very best ahead. The word invest, if you want to find out more about that competition. And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.